Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Today, I'm going to talk about an overlooked aspect of the information that has come out about Fort Huachuca in the recent past. I'm specifically going to talk about Joint Task Force 6, JTF 6, EPIC, the El Paso Intelligence Center, Fort Bliss, and the whole rotten double dealing that's going on in that place, which has resulted in the murder of at least one Army soldier, Richard Halliday. I'll talk more about that. I'll talk about Fort Huachuca. There have been some well-meaning people in the so-called truth movement that have said, well, Fort Huachuca was never on the radar. No one ever heard about it before Mitch Snow came out with his information. And that's not quite accurate. A lot of us that have been investigating the weird science aspects of reality, UFOs, cryptids, and general surface level intelligence matters, are quite familiar with Fort Huachuca. Was even reading message traffic coming out of Fort Huachuca. The military intelligence training schools are there for Army intelligence in particular, but they also have a number of other organizations based there that are in the intelligence community. DISA is there, Defense Information Systems Agency, originally known as Defense Communications Agency. It's essentially a sister agency of the National Security Agency. Electronic warfare is conducted, training for electronic warfare. They're also very big into, and you don't hear much about this anymore, but I became aware of it a long time ago, virtual 3D training goes on there as well. A very advanced virtual reality training. So they don't just do drones there and generic surface level intelligence operations. They get into a lot of very high tech, weird science type stuff. Right now, I'm going to read from this paper I found online. Anyone could have found this. I'll make it available on the website so you can read it for yourself. It's called Tunnel Detection Along the Southwest U.S. Border. Abstract. The U.S. Army Engineer Research and Development Center, ERDC, has worked with U.S. law enforcement agencies, LEAs, and where Joint Task Force 6, JTF 6, is concerned. They work a lot with LEAs. Since 1995, to address the problem of clandestine tunnels beneath the U.S.-Mexico border. That's exactly what Mitch Snow was talking about. And all these surface-level goobers were making light of that fact, right? Let me read that bit again. The U.S. Army Engineer Research and Development Center has worked with U.S. law enforcement agencies since 1995 to address the problem of clandestine tunnels beneath the U.S.-Mexico border. ERDC has performed tunnel-related research, equipment development, or tunnel detection missions at the request of the LEAs, coordinated by Joint Task Force 6, JTF 6 at Fort Bliss, Texas, now known as JTFN for Northern Command U.S. Army. And before I go any further, I'd like to point out that at one time, I don't know about now, but at one point in the past, the Department of the Interior had some element of control or oversight over Joint Task Force 6, the Department of the Interior. I guess in the early days, it was a way to get around Posse Comitatus, the act that forbids the U.S. Army from interfering in or becoming involved in domestic law enforcement operations. Nowadays, Floridization and the dumbing down process being what it is, they don't care if people know that JTF 6 is part of the American Army. And one has to understand that this bogus war on drugs actually predated the bogus war on terror. Not to say that all the death and mayhem and massive relocation of so-called war refugees, asylum seekers, etc., was not real. Of course, it was real. All came about as a result of a war that was premised on eminently false foundations. Ditto the war on drugs. So you have Operation Alliance, counter drug operations between Joint Task Force 6 and law enforcement agencies. And at times, Joint Task Force 6 would request assets from military commands, be it vehicles, helicopters, whatever the case may be. Blatant violation of posse comitatus. Anyway, back to the abstract. Support to Leah's has revealed the importance of understanding the geologic context of a suspected tunnel site as a basis for selecting the appropriate geophysical tools and interpreting anomalies indicated by geophysical data. Tunnel detection missions always involve multiple tools and techniques. A combination of geophysical instruments is used to record data based on different physical principles. When interpreted in a regional geologic context, the combined geophysical methods improve the likelihood of success for tunnel detection. A variable frequency electromagnetic survey tool was developed in the 1990s as part of tunnel detection research and proven at a tunnel test bed near Otay Mesa, California. Also at the Otay Mesa site, an ERDC-led team installed and tested a prototype passive seismic fence, a system that can detect machine and impact noise during the tunnel excavation process. This seismic fence concept has strong potential for deterring tunneling in geographic areas where tunnels have been found most frequently and where cultural clutter limits the usefulness of surface geophysical techniques and tunnel detection. Current ERDC tunnel detection efforts as of March 2005 are coordinated with the National Geointelligence Agency, NGA, formerly NIMA, to combine electromagnetic and radar methods with emerging technology in microgravimetry. Introduction. Clandestine tunnels are being found with increasing frequency along the border between the U.S. and Mexico. These tunnels are known pathways for illegal drugs and people, and potential pathways for even worse threats to the security of the U.S. I would also add that they're also pathways for human trafficking. For the past 10 years, U.S. law enforcement agencies, LEAs, have requested assistance from the U.S. Army to locate clandestine tunnels and deter tunneling activities. Joint Task Force NORTHCOM, JTFN, at Fort Bliss, Texas, serves as a liaison between LEA requests and military technologies applicable to civilian issues. JTFN has tapped the geosciences expertise of the U.S. Army Engineer and Research Development Center to search for geophysical indications of tunnels at locations where human intelligence, UMINT, indicates a tunnel. International military experience beginning with tunnels underneath the Demilitarized Zone, DMZ, of the Korean Peninsula prepared ERDC researchers to lead detection missions, to perform tunneling likelihood assessments, and to determine the applicability of emerging technologies by field trials of geophysical equipment at tunnel test beds established in discovered tunnels. This paper summarizes the ERDC tunnel detection experience in domestic law enforcement settings. Because of the security sensitivity of the subject, individual tunnel search missions are not described. The article mentions how Otay Mesa was one of the test sites. Otay Mesa is a suburb in San Diego County, right near the border, on the border, and it's to the west of San Ysidro, the main border crossing point, port of entry there. I'm going to skip over a lot of technical detail and work my way down to the bottom to parts that are more pertinent to our discussion here. Fuel detection tools and field test. The construction activities, spoils disposal, and noise of tunneling are easily hidden in heavily urbanized areas. Most clandestine border tunnels are very near ports of entry, which are heavily used areas with continuous heavy truck traffic, new construction, earth moving, and other human activities. Construction always begins on the Mexico side, hidden under a building, and proceeds toward and under the border to emerge in another innocent-looking building or partially constructed surface facility. The following section describes evaluation of geophysical methods for their ability to detect and delineate tunnels in this complex cultural zone along the U.S.-Mexico border. Douglas, Arizona and Otay Mesa, California test sites. The Douglas Drug Tunnel was discovered by UMINT, Human Intelligence, in May 1990. It was a reinforced concrete line tunnel approximately 30 feet deep and 300 feet in length, originating at a residence in Mexico connecting to a warehouse in Douglas. This site was used to evaluate several surface geophysical techniques. The Otay Mesa Drug Smuggling Tunnel near San Diego, California, was discovered on May 31st, 1993, also by UMINT. In other words, there was an informant passed on information to someone in DEA or law enforcement or Joint Task Force 6 or whatever. Although the tunnel was never completed, it is the longest tunnel yet discovered, covering a distance of more than 1,450 feet, with a tunnel floor at a depth of 65 feet at the point of entry on the Mexican side, to a depth of 35 feet at the northern end of the tunnel on the U.S. side. That's a serious tunnel by any standards. Due to the easy accessibility to the Otay Mesa site and the possible existence of similar clandestine tunnels along the border, the Otay Mesa tunnel was chosen as a testbed to evaluate more than 20 geophysical methods for detection capability over the tunnel, including both surface and borehole methods that successfully detected and located the tunnel included seismic, electrical resistivity, and surface and borehole EM. Numerous other techniques have been tested at both Otay Mesa and the Douglas sites. What we see here is a sophisticated effort at locating tunnel systems they've been tipped off about, tunnel systems which are quite extensive and are being utilized by the cartels and human trafficking operations. So what, may I ask, is so bizarre or non-credible about what Mitch Snow was saying? When Mitch Snow himself said he was a member of Joint Task Force 6 involved in detecting underground tunnel systems coming from Mexico into the U.S., I would think that people with special forces background, like this Valhalla guy, would know something about that. But JTF-6 went right over people's heads. I'm skipping way down to the bottom because all the stuff in between is highly technical, and I just don't want to spin my wheels talking about all that. You can read it for yourself. I'm just reading the pertinent points for this commentary. Okay, getting down to the very bottom, the acknowledgments, and this is important. Acknowledgements. The work described here benefited from support or participation by Joint Task Force 6 and its successor, Joint Task Force NORTHCOM, the Counter Drug Technology Development Program Office, the U.S. Border Patrol, the U.S. Customs Service, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, and U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, the Colorado School of Mines, the Kansas Geological Survey, and the National Geointelligence Agency, NGA, formerly NEMA. ERDC team members who have contributed to tunnel detection research and tunnel missions include, and they name off a bunch of names. Now, here's a pertinent part of Mitch Snow's testimony, where everything in his life went pear-shaped and everything turned upside down, and the very system he was defending and working for turned against him with a vengeance. And we've seen this countless times before in these black op drug trafficking operations. The world first heard of Mitch Snow in his interview appearance on Candace Owens' show. So before I delve into Mitch's story, I want to talk a bit about Joint Task Force 6. Years ago, I used to subscribe to a quarterly publication called The Resistor. The Resistor. It was a quarterly publication put out anonymously by a number of Army Special Forces individuals, Green Berets, in various bases, out of various bases and locales around America, and also, from what I understand, contributions came from Green Berets from other parts of the world. One of the things that they were concerned about was the militarization of law enforcement. And this was a concern that many people in law enforcement had as well, because a lot of the older veterans were seeing how Army Rangers were coming in and giving training, and there was a lot of police department and sheriff's department personnel being sent overseas to certain countries for training of how to deal with and subdue captive populations, let's say. These former and current Green Berets that made up the editorial staff of the Resistor publication were particularly concerned about the activities of Joint Task Force 6, JTF-6, which back then and probably still is based or connected to Fort Bliss. And Fort Bliss is where EPIC is. EPIC is El Paso Intelligence Center, which was a hub, a nodal point for counter-drug law enforcement activities. EPIC was the headquarters for the Drug Enforcement Administration. And I alluded earlier to the murder of the Army soldier, Richard Halliday. He was murdered by drug cartels connected to military personnel on Fort Bliss. So in the very same base where EPIC is housed, El Paso Intelligence Center, which is supposed to be the hub, the nexus of all counter-drug operations in the Southwest, well, they have a cartel military intelligence drug trafficking operation running right through there. And Richard Halliday found out about it somehow, and he disappeared, and apparently his body was dismembered eventually, and parts of his body wound up in Mexico. And I don't want to speculate what may have happened. We know that so much black magic, Santeria, they have specific death cults coming out of Latin America that have long since infiltrated into America. It's open to question what happened to Richard Halliday's body parts. I hope the family can reclaim all the body parts eventually. So keep that point in mind. There's always been this group, probably stronger in the past than they are today, because there's no institutional memory. You look at a guy like Valhalla, the Green Beret guy, who was talking trash about Mitch Snow. He didn't even seem to know what Joint Task Force 6 was. He didn't even know that GIGN had operated overseas and rescued French children in Djibouti. He didn't even know that 2nd REP was embedded with the 13th Demi Brigade in Djibouti and worked with GIGN to rescue those children. He didn't know all of that, and he's commenting upon the revelations that Candace Owens had about the hit that was put on her by the French, right? Because of her exposure of the Macrons. So these were real patriotic, active duty, and former Green Berets who were putting out this publication, and they were deeply concerned about JTF-6 and Operation Alliance and EPIC, because they knew there was something shady about them. JTF-6 operates throughout the national forest of the country, the Cleveland National Forest, They spent a lot of time, have spent a lot of time there in the past. Cleveland National Forest is east of San Diego, and they spent a lot of time in there. One thing I should mention about Candace Owens, I'm really glad that she's delving into this real deep woo Anunnaki kind of Nephilim Project Looking Glass. I mean, she's delving into all those issues, and I'm really grateful that she is because it'll wake up a whole new audience to that information. And eventually, all real people on the truth hunt need to go in that direction. So, kudos to her. So, what I'm going to say now, I may blow a lot of these surface level truthers out of the water, but I've always felt, and I have no reason to doubt it, that within JTF6, there may be a deep black element within it that has been briefed or is cognizant of cryptids, Sasquatch, Bigfoot, etc., because they spend so much time in the forest and in the wilds and in the desert areas where a lot of these cryptids are known to exist. So, just food for thought. And Joint Task Force 6 probably has about the same effectiveness as the Drug Enforcement Administration. We know that the biggest drug traffickers in the world are routinely listed in the DEA database as being protected intelligence sources, protected intelligence sources for the CIA. And we know that the CIA is deeply embedded in the DEA and essentially controls it. We see the abysmal track record of the DEA over the years. There's no reason to suggest that JTF6 is making America any safer from drugs than the DEA is. And if the CIA is in control of the DEA, and if the DEA has a nexus point, a nodal point base, epic right there in Fort Bliss, well, we can say with some degree of certainty that the CIA would be in control of EPIC, the El Paso Intelligence Center. Now let's get to the story of Mitch Snow. Mitch Snow says that he was with JTF6, that he was conducting operations along the border to identify, locate tunnel systems. What did I just finish reading? That the cartels were using to traffic drugs and probably people into America. And what happens? He happened to be part of a team that found active tunnels being utilized by the cartels. So what happened was entirely predictable. The system came down on Mitch like a ton of bricks, turned his life upside down, rigged up these phony charges of child abuse and spousal abuse, domestic violence against him. We've seen this again and again and again. And people like Valhalla, Green Beret just fall for it because they're just dangerously naive. They have no idea how the real world works. They think they do, but they don't. So the Just Us system, the powers that be, do everything to destroy Mitch's life. Let's just give a few examples of other people whose lives were destroyed because they found out either as part of the job or inadvertently about this massive mega drug trafficking operation, state sponsored. What about the boys on the tracks? These two young teenagers out in the woods in Arkansas, they stumble across a nighttime airdrop, bundles of cocaine dropped into a clearing. They happen to be there when the retrieval team comes along to pick up the drugs. They find these two kids, they sodomize them, murder them, then they lay their bodies on a railroad track where they get run over and mutilated. And then the official story comes out that they smoked pot, got so stoned they decided to lay down on railroad tracks and sleep. We know how ridiculous that is. Look what happened to Green Beret William Tyree. William Tyree was caught up, much against his will, I'm sure, in Operation Watchtower, a joint CIA Green Beret Mossad operation running drugs out of the Panama Canal Zone from Colombia first, Panama Canal Zone, at that time controlled by the U.S. military, into the colonist continental U.S. through military bases. Fort Devens, I think, was one of them. I think that was where William Tyree was stationed. He was part of the operation. His wife happened to be a member of the Army's Criminal Investigative Division, CID. And Tyrell and his wife were keeping records, keeping evidence about what was going on. So what happens? Someone, and some people suspect it was a Green Beret, a fellow Green Beret, went into his home, killed his wife, beheaded her, and then William Tyree was framed. If he's still alive, he's rotting away in a federal pen. Another Green Beret, this time a colonel, Edward Catolo, was involved with Operation Watchtower. He kept a thick affidavit of all the documentation and all the information and all the intelligence he gathered, and was killed in an automobile accident. Colonel Edward Catolo. Colonel Catolo was the commanding officer of the 10th Special Forces Airborne at Fort Devens, Massachusetts. And I'll get into more of his career, his background, what happened to him later. He was part of Operation Watchtower, or at any rate was aware of it. He'd spoken to some of his subordinates who were directly involved and gathered a lot of information about it, especially about the CIA's involvement, involving high-level CIA personnel, Thomas Kleins, Frank Turpel, Edwin Wilson, the same suspects, the usual suspects. How about another Green Beret colonel that was bumped off? Oh, before I get ahead of myself, Colonel Nick Rowe, the person who they named the U.S. Army SEER course after, Survival, Escape, Resistance Evasion. Colonel Nick Rowe, who spent like 6 or 7 years in a Viet Cong POW camp until he escaped. Well, he couldn't escape his fate because he was aware of the drug trafficking, and he worked with Colonel Edward Catolo to get to the bottom of it. He was conveniently bumped off when he was a military advisor to the Philippines, and these Filipino communist guerrillas ambushed him and bumped him off. How convenient is that? About Dr. Jeffrey McDonald. The Jeffrey McDonald case is what brought Ted Gunderson into the fold as far as researching satanic cults and their involvement in drug trafficking, their involvement with military intelligence, military psychological operations. Jeffrey McDonald was a Green Beret medic who was framed for the murder of his wife and his two daughters at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. It was a satanic murder of his family, and he was framed by the military police, the CID, the aforementioned Criminal Investigative Division, for the murder of his wife and his two children. And Ted Gunderson concluded that he was innocent. It was a satanic cult. In fact, he'd spoken to a woman who took part in the murder and was present at the time. And she stated he was innocent. He'd been knocked out while they killed his family. And then they framed him. They even wrote a book about him, making it seem like he was guilty. I read the book years ago called Fatal Vision. Innocent man hung out to dry. We've seen this again and again and again. So when Mitch Snow rocks up and he says, well, I was at Fort Huachuca to try to get information relative to all the harassment, the problems I've been having since I was with JTF 6 years ago, and we discovered along the border these tunnel complexes which the cartels were using. Well, if they come down on him for finding tunnels used by cartels, that has to be intelligence involvement, because the cartels are not the ones that it's going to ruin his life with the Justice Department and the military and everything else. The family court system, the CPS, he was set up and framed for domestic abuse, for child abuse. And the tragedy is he has a special needs son, and his wife is the one that's the whack job. His wife is the one that's neglectful of the child. His wife is the one that's abusive toward the child. and Mitch is trying to get his son to safety, but then people like Valhalla Green Beret guy, they just go on with the prevailing narrative because they don't do any real research themselves. Mitch Snow was framed. He was set up the same way, but he hasn't been bumped off yet. But wouldn't it surprise me if they try to bump him off. But like I said, look what happened to William Tyree, Edward Catolo, right? Now, Edward Catolo was a made man in the mafia, and he was still bumped off. It didn't matter. So Mitch Snow went to Fort Huachuca to get paperwork to help get him out of this mess that he's in, that was done to him. The outrageous allegations, the outrageous fraud that was perpetrated against him. His only crime, quote unquote, was discovering these tunnels. And what did I just do earlier? I read a paper from the U.S. Army Engineer Research and Development Center and how they developed this technology to identify and locate tunnel systems. And in the document I read, it specifically mentioned that Joint Task Force 6 used that technology in order to find tunnels. That's exactly what Mitch Snow said. Now I'm going to talk a bit about Fort Huachuca and why it's so critical. They do electronic warfare there. They do advanced drone operations there. I alluded earlier to the very high-tech three-dimensional virtual reality training there. And I looked in recent websites about Fort Huachuca and whatever open public sources I could find, no mention of the virtual 3D training program they have there. And if memory serves, I think I found out about it when I was at the AFCEA conference, one of the AFCEA conference, Armed Forces Communications Electronics Association. Every year, I don't know about anymore, but in the past, every year they had this big conference in the San Diego Convention Center. And because I was a database coordinator for ComNav AirPAC Communications, I had a free pass to go every year. And most of the briefings and presentations were unclassified. A few were secret level clearance. And you had all the contractors there, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon. You had all the various commands. And if memory serves, I think there was even a booth from Fort Huachuca. At any rate, I came across a brochure that talked about this advanced virtual 3D training going on at Fort Huachuca. And you can imagine kind of scenarios they could program into that, right? I don't know, political assassinations? Who knows? I also wanted to mention some of the deep black activity that has gone on at Fort Huachuca. Years ago, I attended a lecture by the great Jorge Martin Miranda, and he talked about the chupacabras. Many of you who have followed Jorge Martin's work know that the chupacabras is a big part of his research, especially being based there in Puerto Rico. He was told, Jorge Martin was told by his sources, and I can't remember exactly if they were with the Puerto Rican National Guard, within the FBI, whatever the case may be, or Army intelligence, but somewhere along the line, he was told about the capture of, I believe, two. Don't quote me on this, I may be wrong as far as the numbers go, but if memory serves, the capture of a couple of chupacabras. And these were caught in Puerto Rico and brought back to, of all places, Fort Huachuca. And the reasoning behind that is the controllers wanted to see how the chupacabra would react and adapt to an alien, for it, an alien environment. Remember, Puerto Rico is a very lush island. You have the El Yunque forest, you have jungles, you have dense undergrowth, etc. Well, you take the chupacabras out of that location, you bring them to the desert. They want to see how they're going to adapt. And if memory serves, unfortunately, I no longer have the audio cassette because I've recorded the presentation. But if memory serves, and I have a pretty good memory about these things, the purpose was to bring the chupacabras, two of them, to Fort Huachuca and eventually to release them to see how they would adapt and if they would be able to survive. Chances are, I'm just guessing, I could be wrong, they may have implanted some tracking devices upon the chupacabras and then they turn them loose and see how they adapt. There is a large underground base beneath Fort Huachuca, surprise, surprise. And I believe the chupacabras were put in this underground base before they were turned loose. Before too long, we start having reports of chupacabra and chupacabra type attacks in the desert southwest. And just to clarify, it's possible I heard this information when Jorge Martin was a guest on my show, this show that you're listening to. Again, I'm going by memory. So he either mentioned this on my podcast, and which means I probably have to go back and listen, or he mentioned it at a lecture I attended way back when, or at any rate, a lecture somewhere, and somehow I got a hold of the audio cassette. Because in the old days, if you remember, those of you that were around back then, sometimes these lectures at conferences would be recorded, and then the conference promoters would later sell audio cassettes of the lectures. But the key takeaway from this is these chupacabras were brought back to Fort Huachuca, and it just underscores the very spooky, deep black nature of Fort Huachuca. Interesting side note, I gave a lecture in Philadelphia, and one of the other speakers was individual, formerly with the Army, formerly with a covert operations unit, and his job was to capture cryptids. That was one of his jobs. And he said that a chupacabra was captured in Panama or somewhere in the Panama Canal Zone, Central America, somewhere in that region. And it was flown out. He and his team arrived at Howard Air Force Base in the Panama Canal Zone, which at the time was run by the Americans. He and his team flew in at night, gained custody of the captured chupacabra, and flew it back out to America. And I can't remember where he said, as far as he knew, where the chupacabras were taken. But point of relevance is it shows that what Jorge Martin talked about had some validity. It was corroborated by someone completely different, in all likelihood unknown to Jorge Martin. This was the conference in circa 96, 97. I was in Philadelphia speaking for the late, great Bob Urey, good pal of mine from back in the old days. I was there to give a memorial presentation for the passing of my friend Carla Turner. And it was at that conference that I met this individual, one of the speakers, a black gentleman, a former Army intelligence. And like I said, his job or one of his jobs seemed to involve capturing cryptids or at any rate bringing them back. That's not to say that both cases are related, but what I am pointing out is there's a protocol, a form, as the Brits say, a routine when it comes to, and probably not just for chupacabras, but for other cryptids or other non-human beings at any rate. And we've known this for some time, but yes, there is a pipeline for chupacabras, and one of those pipelines ends in Fort Huachuca. Go figure. Candace Owens also hit on the Mormon connection, interestingly enough, and the Green Beret CIA military intelligence connection with the same. We're also going to talk about real estate fraud. Candace Owens uncovered some of that amongst Erica Kirk's family dealings in real estate. And that's key. That's a key mega layer, mega level of fraud that goes back at least as far as Iran-Contra days. I'm going to talk more about that. What's endlessly fascinating to me, and probably fascinating for others too, is how Candace is uncovering this in real time with the help of all these online sleuths. They're doing what these scum journalists, so-called, should have been doing in the first place, and look in the direction she's heading, and she's not flinching or not balking at, oh, this is getting too weird or too science fiction-y, whatever. She just plows ahead where the information is to be found. It's as if she's uncovering an Iran-Contra level and beyond scandal in real time. And that is so valuable in this day and age. How Candace and benevolent forces working through her are going in these directions. Okay, a bit about the Mormons. Those of you that have been studying at least the surface level aspects of the fraud, conspiracies, secret societies, etc., know the key role the Mormons have always played since their foundation by a 33rd degree Freemason who said that he had an encounter with a being he called Morani or Moroni, and it was described, or he described it as, like a white salamander with wings, right? A white humanoid upright salamander with wings. To me, that sounds like a white Draco or a white Drac, but that's just me. If you really want to get an understanding of the origins of Las Vegas as a power, read the book, The Money and the Power, The Making of Las Vegas and the Hold It Has on America by Sally Denton and Roger Morris. That is a classic book. It goes into detail about the role the Mormons played. The Mormons provided a lot of the seed money to get Las Vegas rolling. Yes, we know that Bugsy Siegel, Meyer Lansky started the whole thing, but the Mormons played a key role in underwriting a lot of the efforts to really expand it. Mormons had a lot of powerful connections with the governor's office of Nevada, with the mayor's office of Las Vegas, and with the sheriff's office. I mean, you name it, the Mormons were well connected. Church of Latter-day Saints, i.e., the Mormon Church, has always been a fertile recruiting ground for the CIA and other intelligence agencies. If you look at the basic profile of a Mormon, I wouldn't say they're hoarders, they're preppers. They proselytize all over the world. They send missionaries out to different countries, so they'll have passports. They'll have spent considerable amounts of time, some of them, many of them, in foreign countries. They will know foreign languages. They will have developed connections in foreign countries. They have a lot of money behind them. So you can see all these things would make them appealing to a CIA recruiter. Also, at the deepest, darkest levels of Mormonism, once again, the ugly head of Satanism, this multi-headed hydra of Satan worship, rears its ugly head or heads, as it were. And there is plenty of information about that if you were to take the time to go find books about the Mormon connection and very, very dark ceremonial magical practices. I've told the story before, but I'll say it again. The Mormon temple in San Diego, actually, it's closer to La Jolla, the financial district, the financial suburb, off of Highway 5, north of Claremont. The Mormon temple there, it looks like like a huge Disney castle. When you drive by it on Highway 5, it looks like a huge, very ornate looking castle. And I had a friend way back when. He used to attend the alien abductee support group meetings that Eve Lorgan and I had. We had that going for quite a while. And he used to attend those meetings every once in a while. And he and I would talk a lot on the phone. He'd tell me what was going on with him. He was having a lot of problems with reptilians, among other beings. But he said that one night he was driving past the Mormon temple at about 3 a.m. He had to do some work in LA or something and was late coming home on the freeway. And as he's driving past the huge Mormon temple there in La Jolla at night, about 3 a.m., he said he saw a flying saucer right above the Mormon temple, beaming a blue light down into the temple. So what I have to ask is, what the hell was going on in there? Was there some kind of six-sorted ritual where the aliens were just beaming down energy in order to hoover up or suck up whatever foul energy had been released down there? Or were they amplifying that foul energy inside the temple? I'm sure they had open portals and vortexes, what have you. Often as not, they place these kinds of edifices, temples, and whatnot, right above known vortex areas, not just little portals, I mean vortexes. And it's quite possible that the Mormon temple in San Diego is sitting atop a vortex. At any rate, this guy drives by, sees a flying saucer beaming a blue light down into the temple right above it. And it just makes me wonder what was going on in there. And also, there's books that you can find. I forget the title of one of them, and I read it. It was about a girl who escaped from the Mormon church because the satanic element of the Mormon church had gotten a hold of her and really abused her, did horrific things to her, but she managed to escape, gave her life to Jesus, and then her life started to improve. But there's a lot going on with the Mormon church that people just don't have a clue about. And getting back to the recruiting aspect, not only does the CIA and other intelligence agencies recruit them, but you will find in Army Special Forces, the Green Berets, so-called, there's a considerable number of Mormons in the Special Forces. Okay, now I'm going to talk about real estate fraud. This is from the book, and I really encourage you to get a hold of this book. It's a must-read in my estimation. The Conspirators, Secrets of an Iran-Contra Insider by Al Martin, a shocking expose of criminal government. Al Martin was an officer in naval intelligence, and this is a really interesting book. Chapter 23, The Bush Family, Corporate Real Estate and Bank Fraud. I thought it would be worthwhile to once again touch upon Iran-Contra fraud, more specifically real estate fraud, and even more specifically, real estate fraud connected to the Bush family. And incidentally, there's a whole books written about George Bush Sr. and his involvement in real estate fraud, fraud in the general mafia connections. As I've said before, Iran-Contra can be divided into three categories: fraud, narcotics, and weapons. Fraud can also be subdivided into numerous categories. The principal categories of fraud would be real estate fraud. Notice how he mentions real estate fraud first. Insurance fraud, banking fraud, securities fraud, and oil and gas fraud. There are many other types of schemes, but these are the principal ones. I've been asked on radio shows and in newspaper articles and interviews, quote, "How could this have taken place? This level of fraud, billions upon billions of dollars that the American people were defrauded of." The enormity of the conspiracy is such that only those who lived it, who were really involved, can truly understand it. Otherwise, it boggles the mind. Real estate fraud is a prime example. Once again, thank you, Candace Owens, for bringing this out. Obviously, you needed the cooperation of an Iran-Contra sympathetic bank, as well as an Iran-Contra sympathetic insurance company. In some cases, and when he says sympathetic, he means CIA-controlled. In some cases, when these fraudulent real estate deals were marketed as public securities, you would in turn need the cooperation of an Iran-Contra sympathetic brokerage firm. The real estate fraud, for example, acts as a cascading fraud through all the components that were necessary to make it work. And there is a completion of a circle in these frauds. When one takes a fraud and follows it from A to Z, and more importantly, follows the money will tell you how large the conspiracy is, and its state-sponsored, or at least state-acquiesced, nature that allowed the fraud to exist. That's why I've consistently called it, and I know it has been confusing to some in the past, Iran-Contra real estate fraud or Iran-Contra banking fraud. These were, in effect, de facto state-sponsored schemes. It could not have worked any other way unless there was state sponsorship or, at the very least, state acquiescence. And he goes into detail about just how it's done. He talks about hypothecation and just goes into details. You really need the book. But the last bit I read there about how it's state-sponsored, state-acquiesced, state-protected, keep that point in mind when you keep hearing about Erica Kirk's mother, Fran, whatever the hell her name is, and she keeps getting involved and opening up all these limited liability companies, dabbling in real estate, and of course, Epstein was involved in real estate. So I really like the directions Candace Turner is going, and I hope she just follows it to its logical conclusion, and eventually she'll see reptilian monsters somewhere in the mix, because they're the ones behind all this, actually. This is a reptilian sphere of influence. It's a reptilian overlordship. I've been saying that for decades, and the proof is in the pudding. As I've said before, the Epstein files, and there's so much of it has been redacted, of course, but the Epstein files is reptilian disclosure. They're describing amongst themselves what reptilian human hybrids do. Okay? If you look at it from that standpoint, yes, it may appear as cannibalism, but they're not really human to begin with. They see us as a food source. They see us as chattel. They see us as a commodity, a resource. You have to understand that. There's no negotiating with these creatures. There's no trying to reason with them. They have no reason to change their behavior. They've been successful in their conquests, star system after star system, using pretty much the same MO, right? They have no reason to change. And I think that's going to be their downfall. The fact that they're so ritualistic, they're so dogmatic, they keep doing the same things over and over. This latest horrific attack on Iran being a classic example. They think they can just bully boy Iran like they did all these other countries. It's not going to work that way. They're censoring so much of the information. Well, the mainstream media is, but there's a lot of great work and research being done by a number of geopolitical analysts. Professor Zhang, of course, comes out with a lot of good stuff, and Colonel McGregor. There's a lot of good stuff and a lot of good sources to get valid information. And I'll talk more about this war later. One last thing in this segment about Epstein. The Epstein files, what I've seen of them, and the commentary of others when they show the emails in question, proves to my satisfaction that Epstein was no errand boy. He wasn't a mere CIA or Mossad agent. He was much more than that. You have Elon Musk like begging to He invited those parties. Bill Gates trying to beg money off of him. He's manipulating things at a very, very high level. Oh, and he's a shapeshifter as well. So he's not even human, folks. And you hear this a lot, that there are millions of others just like Epstein, even worse. Well, maybe, maybe not. But one thing about Epstein is he was a major player. He wasn't an errand boy. He wasn't a gopher. If you look at his training, he apprenticed, did an apprenticeship with Bear Stearns. He was tutored, mentored by Ehud Barak, who played a key role in the formation of the Special Operations Unit of the IDF, known as Sayeret Matkal. I'm probably mispronouncing that. And he also was involved, Ehud Barak was involved in missions with Sayeret Matkal because he was a member of it. Okay, so there's another data point there. These are players at the very highest levels. So what would Epstein need to learn from Ehud Barak? In fact, Professor Zhang, I've been watching some of his videos in the recent past, very interesting, his presentations, and he talks about this training program that Epstein had undergone in all these key critical areas of criminality, of fraud, of blackmail, etc. He was trained by the best, basically, to become what he was, and he was of the right bloodline. He was a key player. He wasn't just a gopher or just a errand boy, an errand boy. I need to make that clear. He was a player at a very high level. I mean, just look at some of the things he was doing at the Zorro Ranch, doing these genetic programs, extracting DNA from Nordic people that helped create this advanced Nordic race. And we know, if you've taken the time to study these things, not everyone knows, but you, my dear listeners, probably know that running in parallel, at times intertwining, on the one hand were the reptilians, lizard people, and on the other hand, the Nordics. And there were times when the reptilians needed the Nordic DNA. And some of these Nordics, some of these Palladian beings, or beings that look like they're Palladians or claim they're Palladians, they're not of the light. I mean, some of these Nordic beings are very evil. And if you go back to ancient Egypt, their pharaonic ruling dynasty was of Nordic appearance, blonde, blue-eyed. In fact, Ramses, one of the Ramses mummies, Ramses the Fourth, I can't remember which one, but he's so well preserved from a mummification standpoint that you can actually see, and I've seen pictures showing this, you can actually see blonde, not only blonde hair left on his scalp, but blonde eyelashes. And what was the headdress for the Middle Kingdom? It was a cobra that the pharaohs wore, this cobra headdress. So there's always been this linkage between reptilians on the one hand and Nordics on the other. And lo and behold, Jeffrey Epstein is doing genetic research on Nordics, of all things. And he was involved in all kinds of other weird science experiments. And he had the money and the power to back it up. So once again, he was a major player. He wasn't a gopher or an errand boy or a mere agent. A lot of people say that Epstein was a Mossad agent. Well, that would be a major demotion for him. Or they say he was CIA. That would be a major demotion for him. He worked above the government level. In the Epstein papers, files rather, it talks about he works for the Rothschilds. He admits he works for the Rothschilds. And another interesting fact is, once again, you hear me talk about Iran-Contra over and over, lo these many years now, because so much of what's going on now can be tracked back to Iran-Contra and before Iran-Contra. According to the Epstein files, Epstein was involved in arms smuggling during the Iran-Contra period, which doesn't surprise me at all. Anyhow, That's the end of this segment. Thank you for listening to Bartley's commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Wherever you may be, whatever you may be doing, have a very pleasant time. We'll see you next time. Bye for now.